I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, we're going to explore the fascinating world of the ghostwriter. We're going to talk with a writer who makes his living by helping other people tell their stories. He's done it so successfully that the books he has ghostwritten have become bestsellers. That man is Mark Tabb, and his new book is Counting the Days While My Mind Slips Away, with former Indianapolis Colt Ben Utek. Please join the conversation. Call 866-476-3881. Email is nolimits@wfyi.org. Facebook is nolimitswfyi. Twitter is WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We're going to be talking today with Mark Tabb. You may not be familiar with his name, but chances are you've read a fair bit of his work. He is a best-selling author, but he actually does not shy away from this term. He's a ghostwriter.
Right.
He helps write other people's books. Mark, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, John. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
It's good to have you. I'd like to invite our listeners to join the conversation if you have questions about the art, and I am going to call it the art of ghostwriting. Please call us at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. So, Mark, let's talk a little bit first about... Yeah, you know, I'm just going to assume that you always had an interest in storytelling,
right,
and in all of that. But most of us, when we set out to do this kind of work, don't say, "Oh boy, I want to grow up and be a ghostwriter. I want to take a back seat, or whatever." So, walk me through the path that led you to becoming a ghostwriter.
You know, John, the first time I had an editor mention ghostwriting to me, I shot him down. Mm-hmm. So I'm a real writer. Those aren't real writers. So, which was a foolish thing to do, because ghostwriting, crawling inside somebody else's head, telling their story from their perspective and thinking like they do, is much harder than just rattling off my own stories. But the process really began, a couple things happened. Is one, I wrote some of my own books. They were very limited in sales, but I ran out of things to say pretty quick. I had a couple of books that I really wanted to write, and after that, it was like, okay, what am I going to do next? And I had I just quit my day job and had gone to a writer's conference.
What was your day job?
I was a full-time pastor at a small church. I was in a small church in Knightstown here in Indiana. And it was, really my day job was also, my wife had gone back to school at the IU School of Dentistry to be a dental hygienist. And so we had three young daughters. So I cooked, I did all the stuff, I did their hair. They would go to school and have the school secretary immediately redo their hair, so.
That's a dad story, yeah.
Yeah, I was kind of a part-time pastor and a full-time dad.
Yeah.
So in 2002 was when I was wrestling with, what am I going to do? And so I went to a writer's conference, made a connection with an editor named Gary Terashita, became very good friends. I did a book for him, and we really connected not on writing but on baseball. So I turned in a book that I had done for him. He was my acquisitions editor, and we were trading emails back and forth, and the playoffs had just started, baseball playoffs. And he bemoaned the fact he was going to have to root for the Yankees that year. And I said, well, why is that? Because he hated the Yankees, and I grew up a Yankee fan. And he said, well, we're going to have one of their players that's probably going to write a book for us. And I don't know where this came from, but my response was, how did you get Andy Pettit? And he's going to need some help, isn't he? I had never really thought about ghostwriting, but just something sparked in me. And his reply was, well, how did you know it was Andy? And, yeah, he's going to need some help. Are you interested? And I had never done it before, and I kind of figured it out along the way. And it was a very small book. It was a very, very limited target audience, but it was a good thing to get my feet wet with, and we just went from there.
Well, what did you know in terms of starting the process? Walk me through, you know, how you tried to write, and I guess let me take a step back from that. Let's talk about how we define ghostwriting. What is ghostwriting, at least in your view, the way you practice it?
The way I practice it is there are people out there who have incredible stories that need to be told, but they're not writers. They need a storyteller. And so I come alongside them, and I listen to them. In fact, I was last week I was up in Benton Harbor working on a new project, doing the initial interviews. I'm very, very excited about this book that's about so timely because it deals with the police, the black community, injustice. I mean, it's a dynamite story. So what I do is I sit down with whomever I'm working with, and I start asking them questions, getting them to open up. And, you know, it's not just tell me your story, but I'll start asking specific questions about the episodes in their story. And I start asking for more details. And one of the people I had the privilege of working with was Alec Baldwin. I worked with him on the book that he wrote about his experience with the family court system and trying to stay connected with his daughter while going through one of the most public, you know, most messy divorces ever. And Alec told me, he kind of summed up what he thought my job was. He said, you know, Mark, your job is to take people back through the worst episode of their life and have them describe it in great detail. Well, in some ways that's true because, you know, stories are not, the stories that are compelling are stories where people have gone through very difficult times and have survived. They've come out the other side. They've come out with hope. They've come out with changed direction, new priorities. There's something that the reader is going to take away and go, yeah, where during the midst of that book, they start rooting for them. But that never happens with, you know, just sunshine and roses and puppy dogs. It's always through tragedy, through difficulties, through great loss. And that's what I take people back through. But then we come out the other side and give the reader hope. And that's really what my goal is. I want the, when the reader shuts the book, I want them to go, oh, my gosh, I can't believe how this played out. And I've got to tell somebody else about it. If they do that, I've done my job.
If you're just joining us, we are talking with the writer Mark Tabb. You may not recognize the byline, but you, chances are you have read some of his work. He is one of the most successful ghostwriters around. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. So you started really ghostwriting with the Andy Pettit book.
Yes.
Take me through that journey with Pettit. I mean, you said it was a small, limited kind of
kind of
book. What did you have to learn? What skills did you have to acquire that you hadn't had in your previous books?
I had to, well, I was a pastor before I started writing. And one of the primary skills I had to have as a pastor was I walked with people through tragedy. Because, I got to be honest, I was bored out of my mind as a pastor. I apologize to my former parishioners for saying that, but I was bored out of my mind because it really wasn't challenging. But the time that I felt like where I would say, this is why I'm doing what I'm doing, is when I would walk with people through tragedy and listen to them. So with Andy, he wasn't going through any kind of personal tragedies. It was a book about purity. Yeah. And what I learned is I had to really listen. But then I don't know how to describe it. When I work with somebody, I try to crawl inside their head. I try to see through their eyes. I begin to try to think like them. Because when there's stories that are being told, little details get left out. So I crawl in there, and I try to relive that situation in my mind, and I think to myself, what would I do if I was him? And it's funny because so often those details are right. They had to make minor changes. I did a book. Hold on.
Certainly. Certainly.
Sorry.
It's okay.
I did a book a few years ago called The Sacred Acre, which was about a football coach named Ed Thomas. He had a little bitty school in Iowa. Four players were in the National Football League at the same time from his school. That story begins when a EF5 tornado tears through Parkersburg, Iowa. And so that's where we opened up the book, was him walking out of the school, looking up in the sky, seeing the clouds get dark and everything. And so as we go through the tornado, after I wrote those chapters, I sent them off, and the family looked at them, and the police chief, who's a close personal friend of the family, and as they read through them, the police chief, he asked a question. He says, "Was Mark here when this happened?" And to me, that was just like, yeah, that's my desire. So that's the process of trying to crawl inside their head to see things the way they would, to try to think like they do. In fact, on that one, that first one with Andy Pettit, you know, I was figuring it out as I went along, and I'd tell my wife when I was going to work, I said, well, I'm going to go channel a 6'5", 200-pound cut, left-handed pitcher, one of the best in the game. I'm going to go become him for a little while. And I think my wife would probably joke like, well, could you, you know, pretend to make some of the money that he's making right now? I think he had a $16 million contract at the time. But, you know, that's it. I basically become the other person in my mind.
You said that the Andy Pettit book was about purity.
Mm-hmm.
Out of this process, because it's a collaboration between you and you know, the purported author.
Right.
Did Andy Pettit come up with that theme, or did that theme emerge out of your conversations with him? You know, did he approach you and say, I want to do a book about purity?
The publisher approached him about writing it.
Okay.
And that's because Andy, I tell you, he was one of the most genuine people I've ever been around.
Yeah.
And for example, while we were working on the book, I went down to spring training, and he had moved to the Houston Astros. And so we're down there at spring training. We were in Cincinnati. He was still with the Yankees. And the Yankees were playing in Cincinnati. I went down to spend the day with him. We worked on the book. We broke for lunch. We were walking across the square there in downtown Cincinnati. And, you know, somebody came up and had him sign their baby.
Mm-hmm.
Which was surreal.
Signed the baby.
Yeah, he signed the baby. Because he told me all those things as we were going down. He said, oh, people are going to ask me for autographs and everything's going to end up on eBay. So somebody had him sign their baby. I said, hey, that's not going to end up on eBay, is it? But we go to a restaurant. We go in, and he asked, how long is it going to, you know, need a table? How long is the wait going to be? And they told him, you know, like 15 minutes. So like, okay, so he just takes the thing and goes and stands. You know, we go take our spot out in the foyer or somewhere. And I'm thinking to myself, that season he won 21 games, which is highly unusual. Mm-hmm. He's the top left-handed pitcher in baseball. And he didn't say, do you know who I am? Nothing like that. It was just the humility about him. And so that was one of the things of just getting to know him and how genuine he really was. That was a great experience.
But in terms of the theme, did he arrive at that?
I know the publisher
said, we want to do this idea.
Right.
Or
what was interesting was, I talked to the publisher, and so my first question, I said, you know, Andy, we want to talk about how you get out of difficult situations and keep yourself pure. And he goes, you know, I don't really have a lot to say about that because I've built my whole life around avoiding those kinds of situations. And I just smiled, and I thought, there's my story. Mm-hmm. There's my angle. That's where we're going to go. So really the way we had the overall theme, but the way that we told it came out of those conversations and collaborating together. Because one of the things that I also will do is I'll make connections where people haven't seen it before.
Yeah.
And I'll bring it up and they'll go, oh my gosh, this is, yeah, exactly what we want to talk about. And so it really is a collaborative process.
Now, are there ever people, admittedly, they've signed the book contract,
right,
and there's some economic pressure. But, you know, if you came to me and said, you know, part of this deal is I'm going to crawl inside your head and look at the world through your eyes, I think, oh, I'm not sure I'm comfortable with that. Is there some reluctance you have to work your way through?
From other people?
Yeah.
Absolutely. Because one of the biggest issues that I've run into with people, and this hasn't happened a lot, but it's happened a few times, where they're not completely honest.
Mm-hmm.
And I tell them, look, you got to get real because people aren't going to believe you. And I can tell you, I don't really have time before the first break, but the second collaborative book I did, after I turned it in, the publisher called me and said, we're not going to do this. I said, why? She goes, I don't believe him. And she goes, he's just not being real. And so I had to go back to the guy and say, listen, you got to get honest with me or this whole thing's over.
Yeah.
And he had to go lock himself in a hotel room with the tape recorder and tell the stories that he couldn't even tell me to my face, and then sent them to me. And I rewrote the book in 2 weeks, and it's still in print today.
If you are just joining us, we are talking with best-selling ghostwriter Mark Tabb. You won't recognize the byline, but you'll recognize a lot of the books. His most recent book is Counting the Days While My Mind Slips Away, that he has written with former Indianapolis Colt Ben Utek. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at NoLimitsWFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today with best-selling author Mark Tabb. You're probably not familiar with the name because the books he writes are generally, he's a ghostwriter. I mean, there's no no other way to get around this. And we're talking about the art of ghostwriting. Should say his most recent book, most recent of more than 30, is Counting the Days While My Mind Slips Away. He wrote that with former Indianapolis Colt Ben Utek. So before the break, we were talking about the episode where I think you said it was your second collaborative
yes.
book. and I suppose the people who are really determined can go looking at Amazon and chronologically and figure out which one that was.
Yeah.
But that issue of what do you do if the person whose story you're supposed to tell is not being, well, I was going to use the word forthcoming, but honest mm-hmm. with you, isn't sharing the story. Over the break, we were talking a little bit about the famous example of the great baseball writer Roger Kahn, who did one of Pete Rose's autobiographies. And was furious afterwards because, you know, it turned out that Rose had lied to him.
Right.
And all of that. What sense of moral responsibility do you have when you're sitting with someone and you think, okay, the bull detector's going off, and you mm-hmm. think, okay, this person is just not giving me the truth?
When I'm working via FaceTime or Skype, which I try to do a lot so I don't have to travel as much, I pull out my iPad and I start Googling.
Yeah.
I start checking and doing what I can within my power to make sure what they're telling me lines up. Now, I haven't really run into the kind of problem that he did, but I guess, no, actually, I have.
Well, one could argue,
sense,
too, that Kahn, there was a pretty clear track record that Kahn could have been a little more skeptical coming
right.
in, too.
And that's because one of the things I found is that when you tell a story with somebody where the bad that they've gone through was of their own making mm-hmm. by their own bad choices, nobody wants to look bad.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I've had to press people. I have a project I was working on with a guy that's he was a crack addict.
Mm-hmm.
And I got about 12 chapters into it. I called him. I said, this isn't working. And he goes, well, what's wrong? I said, I don't believe it. I said, you're telling me these stories and you want to look good. There's no way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're telling me how high you were functioning and everything like that with your cocaine addiction. I said, I don't believe it. And if I don't believe it, the reader's not going to believe it. And so we met back together. Came back into town. We spent a week together, and our first conversation, and this book's not out yet. It'll be out sometime next year. Our first conversation, we actually almost got in an argument. I mean, he was just getting very testy
yeah.
with me, but I told him, I said, listen, it's got to be real, and I know you don't want to look bad, but you were a crack addict.
Yeah.
People don't use that in a positive term, so I got to see the real you, or this isn't going to work. And he came around.
Now, have there been projects that you've just absolutely refused to do? People who, and I'm using that, I guess that's the most extreme way, but how do you go about choosing which stories you want to tell, which people you want to work with? Mm-hmm. I mean, is it simply, you know, I know that Michael Caine, the actor Michael Caine, for example, has said, you know, the only criteria he applies to taking a movie role is how much it pays, whether the check will clear.
Right.
But, you know, what standards do you apply? And it's okay to say, by the way, if the check, I'll do it if the check clears. But
there are times, yeah, because I'm self-employed.
Yeah.
And every self-employed person who's listening today will understand this statement. Mm. Self-employment is serial unemployment. Mm. You know, you ride this roller coaster of either being so busy you can't see straight or you've got nothing. Now, those have been leveled out. I have a new agent. I say new agent. We've been together about 3 years. She's the one who brought Ben Utek's story to me. I just finished the memoir. We just turned in the manuscript. I worked with Bennett Amalu, who's the doctor who Dr. Bennett Amalu, who discovered CTE, and she brought that to me. I got a new project I'm just starting on that she's brought to me. So, you know, those have kind of labeled out. But when you're hungry, everything looks, you know, like, oh, maybe I need to do this. But the criteria I use now, I had early on, there was one project that somebody brought, you know, that an agent brought to me. And I got into it just a little bit. We were in the book proposal stage. And, you know, I just told him, I said, listen, I don't believe you. Mm-hmm. And it's not that I think you're lying, but it was a book that had to do with parenting. Mm-hmm. And the child was 7. My oldest daughter's 31. Mm-hmm. I still won't write a book on parenting because I'm like, yeah, I don't know. So it was, you know, I just said, this isn't going to work. This doesn't meet the believability factor for me. Another one I turned down was not very long ago. It was a book that had to do with some people that were involved in a fundamentalist Mormon sect with polygamy, and there was, you know, murder and, you know, prison terms, and had all the things that would really make a fantastic movie, to say nothing of the book. But I so immerse myself in the life of the people with whom I'm working to such a degree that when I'm in the middle of a book, I dream like the people with whom I'm working. Mm-hmm. That's how much I try to see myself, you know, see everything from their standpoint. And I just sat down one day. We were in the process of, you know, negotiating. And I sat down and I just thought, do I really want to plunge my mind and myself into this to that degree that I'm going to effectively tell the story? I was like, man, that's a journey I just really do not want to make because it was just too dark. And then, you know, I did a book one time with a guy on it was about his pornography addiction and how, you know, his marriage was saved. You know, I got recovered from that. When I finished that book, I said, no more of those.
Yeah.
And then after doing Alec Baldwin's book on divorce, I get at least once a month, sometimes weekly. In fact, I got an email just the other day from somebody that's had a horrible experience with divorce and wanted to know would I be open to working with them. And that's my one and only book I'll ever do on that topic. My parents, I went through that as a child when my parents split up. And working with Alec was very enlightening for me because it helped me to understand my father and what he went through so much better than I ever had before. I mean, changed my relationship with my dad. But I don't want to revisit that area again. I'm done with that. So it's more about, you know, do I really want to immerse myself in this topic? And if I don't, then I'm not going to.
What's it like with your subjects? You know, in this case, say an Alec Baldwin, and I'm remembering what you said is that he told you your job was to force people to walk back through the worst experiences of their lives and relive them.
Right.
You know, that's, I've, as I said, I've not ghostwritten books, but I've done penetrating profiles or whatever through the years. And often the people you write about are a little uneasy around you afterwards because they know, oh boy, I really let the guard down and I don't know this person. And, you know, clearly at some level, to write is to make some judgments about things. So the writer, in an in and of himself or herself reveals some things. I got to believe that's going to be a little bit disquieting for some of your collaborators.
Well, what I found, though, is that it takes so long to do a book.
Yeah.
You know, it's a matter of months that a lot of times I become very close to people. Now, part of this, I go back to my training as a, you know, my work as a pastor. The one time I, you know, where I felt like my skill set was there was walking with people through tragedy. And so there's a lot that goes on that's not, doesn't have anything to do with the book. You know, as people are pouring out all these bad details, I don't just go, okay, well, give me more. Mm-hmm. You know, we'll talk about it. We'll go on a deeper level. And many of the people I've worked with, we've become very good friends. Stephen Baldwin, I did his memoir, The Unusual mm-hmm. Suspect. And, I mean, we're good friends to this day. We talk on a regular basis. You know, so it can vary. Now, some people, we do the book and then we go on and, you know, we don't really ever have contact after that. And sometimes maybe they feel a little odd, but usually, I don't know, there's kind of a bonding that takes place when it's something where somebody's gone through some really difficult times. I try to, you know, I really try to help, not just, I'm not there just to tell their story, because if that's all we do, then, you know, I don't really have any interest in that. I'm not just a storyteller. I want to care about the person I'm working with, because at the same time, the reader, when they read these things, they're going to relate. And we want to be able to help the reader to come through on the other side and have a sense of hope as well.
If you're just joining us, we are talking with Mark Tabb. He is an incredibly successful writer whose name you probably have not heard because he's a ghostwriter and has written a number of bestsellers. His most recent book is Counting the Days While My Mind Slips Away. He's written that with former Indianapolis Colt Ben Utek. I've made reference now several times to the fact that that you're this writer that people haven't heard of,
right?
Because you ghostwrite a lot of stuff.
Right.
How difficult was that to surrender that sort of voice? I mean, I'll say during the break, you were telling me. It you know, no one ever notices anything after the you know, the, like on the cover of the Ben Utek book, his name is in pretty big type, yours less so.
Yeah.
And there's a width with it together, and that nobody ever sees anything after the width.
Right. Well, John, you know, it was no problem at all for me. I was always, you know, this was so easy to stand in the shadows and be the ghost.
I think that stuff about you not telling me the truth here is coming back around.
When I first started writing, and I got to be honest, I mean, I'm like everybody. I thought my dream was to have a number one New York Times bestseller.
And you had one.
Yeah. It didn't quite go, you know, but before that, it was like, where my name's on the cover, I'll make a fabulous amount of money, which, by the way, you don't make a fabulous amount of money as a writer. You do it because you love it. And, you know, we've been able to support the family through it. So no complaints at all. But you don't become fabulously wealthy. But I had visions of Grisham, King, Tab. And I was going to buy a new Mustang convertible because I had a 66 Mustang convertible. When I started dating my wife, I was going to buy a brand new one and put the license tag was going to be BSTSLLR. So surrendering that ego took some time. And, you know, I think the time where it was the hardest was my first few. And it wasn't with like this with Andy, but the next couple after that, you know, I'd listened to interviews that people were doing on the book, and it was like they forgot they had any help.
Mm-hmm.
They forgot anybody else played a role in it. Mm-hmm. Now, the big exception to that was both Stephen and Alec Baldwin. I mean, Stephen would tell people, man, Mark wrote the book. In fact, I can do Stephen so well, I could write stuff right now. And you'd never, you know, he wouldn't even know he hadn't written it just because I crawl a little too deep into his head. But when Mistaken Identity came out, which hit number one on the New York Times bestseller list,
and that story, we ought to tell people what that story is about.
Okay, that's the story. Mistaken Identity was a story here in Indiana where there was an accident involving a van from Taylor University.
Yeah.
I have five daughters. Daughter number two was a freshman at Taylor. She was on the cross-country and track teams. When that accident happened, we didn't know where our daughter was. Mm-hmm. We thought she might have been it. We didn't know what the van was. We thought she might have been in it. When we found out she wasn't, she finally called us, and, you know, we mourned with her. I remember when I found out that there had been a mix-up because there was, one of the girls that was killed was misidentified. There was another girl who was in a coma, and they had switched their identities. When I found out that that had switched.
They both were blonde, and they resembled each other.
Both blonde, yes.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
There was trauma, severe trauma, you know. Yeah. And my daughter, Hannah, who's now a third-year resident at St. Vincent Women's Hospital, she's probably listening right now if she has a break, but she came running downstairs just in tears telling me, you know, this nightmare won't end. And that's how I found out that the identities had been mixed up. So then I was contacted by my agent about a year later and asked me if I would be interested in telling that story. And I tell you, that was just an unbelievable experience working with those two families. And so when the book came out, and I thought, you know, because I like hiding in the shadows, I really like that. Mm-hmm. But when the book came out, we were at the Oprah Winfrey Show. The families appeared on Oprah. And I wasn't up on stage. My wife and I were sitting in the audience, and we were listening. And it was hard for me. Mm-hmm. And I was surprised at how hard it was. In fact, we were walking out, and Oprah gave out copies of the book to everybody. And the book I think it came out like the next day. And these two women were walking along, and they were discussing something about the story, and I don't know how that could be. And so I jumped in and answered the question. Well, how do you know? They said. So, well, I wrote the book. And so they got a copy, and they looked, and my picture was on there. And, you know, like, oh, my gosh, I can't believe this. And as I walked away from that, I just remember feeling kind of sick to my stomach. And my wife said, why did you do that? Mm-hmm. Just hide. Mm-hmm. Just let the work speak for itself. And you know, that was kind of the turning point where I just had to really start surrendering that ego. And I think it was, I did a book with a man named Lopez Lamong, who's one of the Lost Boys of Sudan. Mm-hmm. And he was the flag bearer for the 2008 United States Olympic team. Unbelievable story. I think it's one of the best I've ever done. I love that book. But that was the one where I could just really sit back and just totally enjoy the experience of watching him do interviews and everything and not caring at all if my name was ever mentioned or talked about or anything, where I was very comfortable in the shadows. But it took, you know, it took a while because we all have an ego. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it takes a while to have that go away. But I love being able to tell people's stories and see the impact that it has and to be able to hide in the shadows and just kind of take it in and see how it impacts people's lives. And they never know I had any part at all in writing that book. And that makes it even more special.
Is that what keeps you going? Because you alluded to the fact that there isn't a ton of money in writing.
Right.
For at least not commensurate with the amount of work that has to go into it. Sort of reminds me of the, and this is a joke only writers get, there's a great line in one of Elmore Leonard's novels, Get Shorty, where one of the characters asks the rhetorical question, what kind of writing pays best, and then answers it himself by saying, ransom notes. As I say, only writers really get that one. Is that what keeps you going, just the joy of the storytelling and getting inside these other lives?
You know, and I've made a good living at this. Mm-hmm. I mean, we've been able to live. I mean, I've had, you know, not every year has been the same, but I think I love what I'm doing. And every day when I go in my office, I think I can't believe I get to do this. People pay me to get to do this. It's such a great experience.
If you are just joining us, we are talking with Mark Tabb. He is probably the most successful writer you've never heard of. He's a ghostwriter. His most recent book is Counting the Days While My Mind Slips Away, but he's written a host of other books, including at least one New York Times bestseller. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimitswfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. Again, I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking with Mark Tabb. He may be the most successful writer of whom you have never heard. He's a ghostwriter, written a number of bestsellers. His most recent book is Counting the Days While My Mind Slips Away, with former Indianapolis Colt Ben Utek. So I want to get to the latest book, and actually okay. It's the in a bit, but I wanted to just wrap up kind of what we were talking about. What is the book that you have done that was the most difficult for you to execute? Either because the sources were, it was hard to get them to open up, or, you know, in some cases, just hard to get them to understand the significance of their own story.
That's an easy answer. Ironically, my most difficult book came on the heels of the easiest book I'd ever done.
Okay.
The easiest book was with Josh Blyle, who's a community spokesman for the Indianapolis Colts, does a lot of speaking around here. I worked with Josh on his book, One Step at a Time. Mm-hmm. From the time we first sat down for our very first interview to when that book was finished was 6 weeks, which is insane.
Yeah.
And we met for the first time in June, on June the 3rd, 2010, and we signed copies of the book at the Colts' first home game that season.
Wow.
It was crazy. So I came off of that feeling, man, I'm cooking right now. Mm-hmm. You know, the words are flowing. So I went straight from that
book.
Got
an afternoon open. Let's do an epic.
Yeah. Fly. And, yeah. You know, the word, in fact, I just had surgery on my thumb from writing too much.
Yeah.
I'm surprised I didn't have to have it then. So then I started a book called The Sacred Acre, mm-hmm. The Ed Thomas Story.
Yeah.
And it's a very emotional book. Ed Thomas was the only high school coach to appear on the cover of Sports Illustrated. Four players in the National Football League. His picture appeared because he was murdered by one of his former players 1 year after the tornado that came through and destroyed the city, or destroyed the town of Parkersburg. And his football team gave that town hope, brought the town back. He'd been at the same school for 30-some-odd years. Everybody, I mean, when that book launched, The Sacred Acre, when it launched, it was back in Parkersburg. They had a big ceremony. The governor of Iowa was there. Mm-hmm. Chuck Grassley, the longtime Republican senator, was there. A U.S. congressman for that district was there. I mean, this man was highly respected. The book nearly killed me.
Mm-hmm.
As I sat down, and I had tons of interviews that I'd spent a lot of time in Parkersburg, interviewed his wife, his two sons, close friends. I had all this material. And in addition to that, I had DVDs of speeches Coach Thomas had given. I had a file, a huge stack of speeches of his notes. And I had all of this, and I sat down, and I knew how I wanted to write the story, but I had such a hard time. The words, and it wasn't that the words wouldn't flow.
Mm-hmm.
John, I wrote the first chapter 17 times.
Yeah.
And not just 17 revisions. It was start over 17 times. I had another chapter. They all started running together because there was another chapter, which actually was one of the quicker ones to finish, where on Monday I wrote it, finished the whole chapter. On Tuesday I wrote a new version and did that for 5 days. And finally on Friday I got the right one. I was like, okay, we're good. And the reason I finally, because I thought to myself, why is this book so hard? And it finally hit me. I was collaborating with a man who was dead.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to see everything from Coach Ed Thomas's viewpoint. I wanted to understand him. I wanted to understand the impact he'd made. I wanted this book to, my greatest goal was when people who not only knew him, but people whose lives he had changed, when they read this book, I wanted them to say, yeah, it captures the spirit of Ed Thomas. And it was very, very difficult. In fact, by the time I finished it, I sent it in, and the editor I had was one I'd worked with on several books. And I thought, well, you know, I'll have hopefully a few weeks before they call me and say, you got to rewrite this whole thing, because I had no confidence in it being any good at all. And so my editor, her name is Liz Haney. She's an independent editor that had been hired by Zondervan Publishers. And she called me, and she told me, she said, you know, had a couple questions. And I said, so what do you think of the book? She said, it's the best thing you've ever done.
Mm-hmm.
I said, are you kidding me? She goes, no, I love this. She goes, "Do you not?" I said, "No." I said, I can't even go back and look at it. Mm-hmm. I've not reread the book since I wrote it. But it was just, it was so difficult to pull that out. And I lost all perspective even of, you know, is this still any good or not? But it was, you know, it's a book that has really, I mean, I've gotten some great feedback on people who have read it, who have told me how it's impacted their life. And that's really, I mean, that's the greatest feedback of all, is when people will say, "This touched my life." In fact, I just read a review today. I read all the Amazon reviews of my book. Sorry, you're about to ask.
That's okay. No, go ahead.
But
go
I read a review of Ben's book, Ben Utek's book, mm-hmm. on Amazon today. And the last line in this review, they said that once they put the book away, they could not get away from it. It just kept going through their head. You know, they kept just thinking about the story over and over and over and over. It mm-hmm. touched them. And that's the payoff pitch right there. That's what I want to be able to do.
So talk to me about how the Ben Utek book came to be. I mean, and, you know, how you work through telling that story.
Okay. I can't remember the where I saw it, but I read an interview that Ben did, and there was a photograph of him and his three daughters. He now has mm-hmm. four. And when I read the story, I was like, this needs to be a book. There's a book here. So I started trying to contact Ben, never heard back from him. So a few months went by, and I saw another interview that he did with the Indianapolis Star. And when I reread it, it just reaffirmed. I was like, this has got to become a book. So I contacted an agent in New York who's with a large literary agency there that I'd worked with before. I have an agent who just works with ghostwriters.
Mm-hmm.
She's fabulous. Madeline, if you're listening, you're the best. But this was somebody with whom she had connected me. And so his name is Steve Ross down in New York. And I emailed a link to the story to Steve and said, "I think this is a book. What do you think?" I didn't hear anything back from him for about a week.
Mm-hmm.
And so I sent him an email and said, "You know, Steve, did you get the link that I sent you?" His emailed response said, "I'm sorry, I haven't had a chance to get back with you. I finally connected with Ben. Absolutely, this is a great story. It's going to be a great book." And he hadn't written me back because he just jumped on it. And so he was able to contact Ben, and the two of us connected. Ben was hesitant mm-hmm. at first because, you know, it's something that I knew we were on the track to a really good book, because he, one of his first things is, you know, "I'm not sure that I really have enough to tell."
Mm-hmm.
Well, he did. He had more than enough. And it's just a great guy. I tell you, I don't know, I can't say enough good about him. Ben has become a very good friend. And so we sat down and we worked over the phone to put together mm-hmm. a book proposal, which Steve Ross took, and then sold it. Howard Books, which is the same, ironically, the same publisher that did Mistaken Identity,
mm-hmm.
published this book. And so I flew up to Minnesota to spend a week with Ben. And, you know, the book is about the toll that football has taken on his life
mm-hmm.
with the brain trauma that he has suffered. It's not just through the five concussions, mm-hmm. but it's through the subconcussive hits as well. So our second day together, this is where it told me there, you know, what I was dealing with. A second day together, it's about 10 o'clock in the morning, Ben said, "Hey, have you seen the new Mission Impossible movie?" And Rogue mm-hmm. Nation had just come out.
Mm-hmm.
I said, "Yeah, I've seen it. Have you?" He goes, "No, I really want to." It's like, "Okay, tonight, let's go see it after we're done here." And he had a speaking engagement that evening at a college. He was speaking to their, you know, their sports teams. Mm-hmm. And so he said, "We'll go after that. We'll go to the late show." So, all right, great. So we talked about it all day. You know, he told me how excited he was. We go to the speaking engagement, then we went and got something to eat. We're still talking about the movie. We go to the theater. You know, and every Mission Impossible movie starts off with Tom Cruise doing something crazy, this time mm-hmm. hanging off the side of an airplane. And then they light the fuse and fire up the music, mm-hmm. and the credits come up. When the fuse was lit, and the theater where we were was nearly empty, the fuse was lit, Ben leans over to me and he goes, "I saw this last week, but I have no idea who I saw it with."
Oh,
he's
boy.
34 years old.
Oh, boy. Yeah.
And at that moment, you know, it's not just, this wasn't just about a book. I mean, mm-hmm. there's times it was very hard for me to, because I'm just thinking about, you know, this man has become a very good friend. And to think about what that game did to him, it upsets me. It really does.
What was the hardest of the stories you have told for you to let go of? And I can tell, I'm going to talk here for a second because I can tell you're a little bit upset by the story you just told about,
yeah,
about Ben, to give you a second or two to collect your thoughts. But what has been the hardest one to let go of that had the most impact on you? Because we talked about the fact that what you do is almost like method acting. You
right.
have to crawl into a character, in
right.
this case, a real human being skin.
Well, right now, and this answer may change, right now I'm going to say it's Ben's story. And the reason for that is, as soon as I finished, while I was still writing Ben's book, we were still working together, my agent called me and said, "We got a new project for you." I said, "What is that?" She said, "Have you seen the previews for the movie Concussion?" I said, "Yeah, can't wait to see it." So, well, it's about Dr. Bennett Omalu. Mm-hmm. He wants to write his memoir. You're the guy to do it. Mm-hmm. And so we had the same team, Steve Ross, the agent on with representing Bennett. So what has happened, John, is you go back to probably April of last year until a week and a half ago, I was up to my neck in stories of the National Football League, football, brain trauma. One of the chapters I wrote for Bennett, I described in great detail what happens on a microscopic level in the brain. And there was just story after story after story of lives that had been destroyed, but also of how the National Football League covered up what they knew and also tried to destroy this man's life. It's gotten to, so now, because I grew up in Oklahoma where football is a religion,
mm-hmm.
and the high greatest holiday of the year wasn't Christmas. It was
Oklahoma and Nebraska game.
Yeah.
Right? Yep.
I was there when the fumble Ruski took place. So for me now, not only do I not watch football, my wife has told me, because people say, "Are you going to watch the Colts this Sunday?" "No, I don't really watch football." And, my wife and I got to go to the Super Bowl when they played the Saints. I was there when they played the Bears, which was mm-hmm. kind of a cool perk of my job because I got to go for free. But anyway, now it's like, somebody starts asking about football. I have to just kind of step away because I will just start spewing. It's had such – it's just been chilling to think, man, this game that I love has had this kind of impact on people. And I have to step back. Part of that is because I'm just so inside their head, so I'm seeing things through – the eyes of Bennett Omalu, Dr. Bennett Omalu, and through Ben Utek. And so I have to kind of step back, and I'm finally maybe getting to a place where I can start looking through my own eyes again, but I still don't think I'm ever going to watch football again.
We've gotten a Facebook question from our regular listener named Gary, who says, and I'm going to paraphrase Gary, can anyone employ a ghostwriter? And if so, what are the costs associated?
It's expensive
mm-hmm.
because I do this for a living.
Mm-hmm.
I'll do, last year I did 3 books that mm-hmm. all came out this year. And so you just do the math on what does it take for somebody to make a living doing this.
Mm-hmm.
And so, it's pretty expensive, and so I do a lot of books. The people I work with are not celebrities and are not wealthy, but, so my fees come out of the advance on royalties that the publishers pay. So, anybody can hire one, but you've got to, for publishing is a really difficult world to break into.
Mm-hmm.
And so it has to be a very, very compelling story for a publisher to be interested and to actually, pony up the money, to actually do an advance. I guess it's not a very proper way of putting it, pony up the money, but actually to have an advance of such a size where you can afford to do it.
To invest in the project.
Yeah, it's an investment for the publisher. They're putting themselves on the line as well.
How do you know when you talked about, with the book about the coach in Iowa, mm-hmm. Ed Thomas, was it?
Yes.
Ed Thomas, that you had one chapter you rewrote 17 times. When do you know it's good? When do you know you've captured the person?
You just know. I mean, there's something. I compare it. I mean, this is the difference between being a writer, and a lot of mm-hmm. people want to write.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're a writer, the struggle is part of it. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are days I've gained weight. I haven't had any gaps in my schedule and writing for a few years now. And I've, you know, I gain weight with books because I snack a lot. I'll have a bowl of M&Ms there because there's all this nervous energy going. And it's just like a battle between me and that page. And even though I have people's material, their story, you know, it's like a, just a pile of raw materials. Mm-hmm. How am I going to make this into something? And you just know. I mean, that's part of, I guess, you know, just being a writer, having the experience. And I know when it hits me right. Part of that, too, is I read a lot. I read voraciously. When I have a deadline, I read even more.
Mm-hmm.
The last couple weeks I was working with Bennett Amal, working on his book. I don't know. I read 5 or 6 books myself. I'm constantly reading. So that's always to tune my ear. You know, I try to read good writing so that it tunes my ear so that I know, wow, this sounds right.
Now, is that the next book of yours that will be out? And what are some of the other projects you're working on in the couple of minutes we've got left here?
Yeah, the Bennett Amalu book will come out in the fall of next year. It's called Truth Doesn't Have a Side.
Mm-hmm.
I've just started working on a book. Don't know what the title will be yet, that I'm working with a policeman and a man he arrested in Benton Harbor, Michigan, and where they the man was falsely accused. He was innocent, was sentenced to 10 years in prison, and he really was innocent. The cop lied. And when the cop was found out, he went to federal prison. So you would think this would be a story where the man just, you know, the man that was falsely accused wants to kill him, which he did for a while. But his heart was changed, and they now travel the country talking about racial reconciliation. And that's also, that just was signed, just started out last week, and that's supposed to come out next fall as well.
How did you find that one real quickly? I mean, how did you find those folks?
The agent that I worked with on Mistaken Identity called me and said, I think I got another story for us to work on together. And that's been, you know, Mistaken Identity came out, what, 8 years ago, I think?
Well, I think that's probably a great last word. I would like to thank my guest, Mark Tabb, who is, as I've said repeatedly, probably the best-selling author that you're least likely to have heard of because he's been a ghostwriter. Mark, I want to thank you. This has been a fascinating conversation about not just the work you do, but the lives of these other people. And I want to thank you for doing what you encourage other people to do, sharing so completely.
Thank you, John. I just looked up the clock. I thought, well, we've got another segment, right? I can't believe the hour is already gone. This was great fun.
It goes quickly. I'd also like to thank our listeners and invite them to come back on Thursday when we're going to be talking about domestic violence and what we can do about it. I am John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Executive producer, Michelle Johnson. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive Media Coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical Producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And Board Engineer, Joe Hatcher. Abby Cherzini screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.